I'd like to say a few words about what we're doing here. And looking at the question, why would one want to do this? This sitting, watching the breath, observing the body. Why is that of any value? What's the point of it? Now, I expect each of us probably can come up with some answer. Probably for many of us, because we've found that it somehow enriches our lives. It provides us with something that we're seeking. It seems to offer a way out of a particular impasse. But let's try to locate these practices, these exercises, in the tradition from whence they came. And that tradition is that of the Buddha. And in particular, what makes the Buddha the Buddha is his having had this experience called Bodhi, which is translated either as enlightenment or, more accurately, awakening. The whole of Buddhism, in all of its enormous diversity, finds its origin in this experience of a man, Siddhartha Gautama. Took place about 450 BC in North India, which he called an awakening, a waking up. Now, a great deal has been written about the meaning of this awakening, but let's go back to the earliest sources that we have in the Pali Canon, and in particular to a passage that I have spent a great deal of time thinking about recently, and that is Siddhartha's own account of his waking up that is in the text called the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, the Discourse on the Noble Quest. Now, in this text, the Buddha actually speaks autobiographically, and which, if you're familiar with the Pali Canon, you'll realize that that is not very often that the Buddha talks about himself. But here, he describes, albeit rather cryptically, his process from leaving home to becoming awake. And there is one passage, just about a paragraph long, that he devotes to the experience of the awakening itself. Now, what is striking in this passage is that he doesn't utilize many of the words that we would expect someone who's had such an experience to use. Nowhere in this passage does he claim to know something new or different or special or transcendent or spiritual. The word know and its cognates are not used. Nor does he use the word truth in this passage at all. Instead, he talks in terms of making a kind of existential shift from one condition to another. Let me cite the opening couple of sentences of the text. He starts by saying that this Dhamma that I have arrived at is subtle, sublime, hard to understand, and those who delight and revel in their place find it very difficult to see this ground. And this ground he describes as this gives rise to that, conditioned arising. This gives rise to that, conditioned arising. I feel that that is probably one of the key sentences in the entire Buddhist canon. This gives rise to that, conditioned arising. And he describes that as a ground. But it's a ground that is very difficult to really see if one is preoccupied with what he calls one's alaya, which we could translate as one's place. So the Buddha's describing his waking up as a movement from preoccupation with a place to an openness to one's ground. In fact, there's a kind of word play going on here. The words in Pali for place and ground are more or less interchangeable, in fact. But the Buddha's giving them a very specific meaning in this passage. So what does it mean to be preoccupied with one's place? I think we can understand this in a whole number of ways. Starting perhaps with one's sense of identification with, let's say, a particular physical place, the town in which you live, or the country of which you are a citizen. That there is a kind of identity with that. I am British. I am a Londoner. I am a whatever it might be. That we somehow identify with that place. And identifying with a place, a physical place like this, gives us some sense of location, some position to orient ourselves from in this complicated world in which we live. But place, our place in the world, is obviously not just reducible to our identification with a nation or a town, but also our place has a lot to do with where we feel we stand in our society. It has to do perhaps with a social position, where we locate ourselves in our relationships with others. I find, for example, when I go into an unfamiliar social environment, let's say a party or a gathering or giving a talk like this, that immediately, as soon as I enter that social space, I find myself kind of juggling. Now, who do I defer to? Who do I somehow look down upon a bit? Who am I attracted to? Who do I approve of? And where do I fit into this space? And throughout our lives, we're continuously negotiating our social space, our social position. And we take great offense if once we have a certain idea of who we are, that I'm a professor or a doctor or whatever, and if that's not properly acknowledged, we feel somehow slighted. And so we do spend, or at least I spend, a fair amount of time concerned about my place in the world. But it goes deeper than just physical or social identity. Our place is also defined in terms of our beliefs, of our philosophical beliefs, if we're that way inclined to think of things. Or perhaps more pertinently, pertinently in a setting such as this, one's religious or one's spiritual beliefs. You know, I'm a Buddhist or I'm a Christian. And then we fine grade what particular brand of Christian or Buddhist we are. And we can expend an enormous amount of energy shoring up that identity, distinguishing ourselves as holding a particular position, particular place in that milieu. And if we take this even deeper, let's say into a purely psychological understanding, then of course the whole structure of our ego, of our self, of our I, is very much about feeling convinced that I am this person who holds these views and lives in these places and has these connections. And yet this is something quite private. It's our own story that we keep reiterating to ourselves as to who we are. Now, there's nothing wrong with this. This is simply how human beings operate in the kind of world in which we live. It becomes problematic when we invest too much importance to that particular part of our identity. Now, I think what we might notice in meditation, the sort of thing we've just been doing, is that we do spend time attending to the breath or to the body and to all of these things, which is in fact what the Buddha describes as our ground. And yet so readily and compulsively we might notice how difficult that is. What appears to be a very simple thing, watching the breath for half an hour, turns out to be a terribly difficult thing to do. It's almost as though there's a part of ourselves that feels threatened by it. We'd rather be anywhere than with our breath. I'd rather be indulging some memory of some trivial event. I'd rather be wandering off into this afternoon and tomorrow. And if there's nothing much going on in the past and the future, then I'll just drift around in some haze of free association. And yet if you look into those fantasies and daydreams and wanderings, very much of it has to do with this issue of place, this issue of where do I stand, who am I, what do people think of me, what am I going to do next, where do I fit here or there, am I going to be successful, am I going to fail? There is an enormous force within us, an instinctive, habitual force to constantly return to that preoccupation. My sense is that most of our wandering off in meditation, quite, you know, instinctively, habitually, is a return to the security or the apparent security that is provided by this sense of place. It gives us something to hold on to. It secures us in a world that, in a very real sense, is highly insecure. And not only is our economic life sometimes threatened or our physical health, but finally, this life will fail us and we will die. And that could happen at any time. And I think at one level we know that very intuitively. And it's terrifying. We may have all kinds of rationales that make us feel that we're not really terribly worried about those things. But I think what we often find when we just stop and sit and watch the breath and come back to something so primary as that is that we suddenly become alert to how much of our energies and time are concerned and preoccupied with securing a place of fixity, of something definite, something definable. So the Buddha says, those who delight and revel in their place find it very difficult to see this ground, that this conditions that, conditioned arising. So the practice that we're doing is about opening ourselves to this ground. Now the ground that the Buddha speaks of is not the ground that one might expect in a spiritual or a religious approach. One would normally expect ground to have something to do with God, or some ultimate truth, or the absolute, or spirit, or the soul, or whatever it might be. Something enduring, something fundamental. And in fact, the word the Buddha uses, tana in Pali, for ground, was used in the Upanishads, which is the pre-existent Indian tradition, to refer to God. God is sometimes, or Brahman, is described as the Adhishtana in Sanskrit, which means the foundation, the ground of everything. And God, in Indian thought, utterly transcends the contingent and the phenomenal world. And so the Buddha here is actually going quite against the current of thought at his time, and he's giving a radically new meaning to what he means by ground. By ground, he's pointing to the specific phenomenality of this open field of contingent events, to put it rather clumsily. But what he's pointing to is the thisness of things, the specificity of things. The Buddha moves away, quite deliberately, from an interest in something transcendent or divine, to pay attention to the most mundane things. And so, going back to my example, or the passage I cited before, when a monk goes into a forest, sits at the root of a tree, and then pays attention to whether his breath is long or short. Now, it doesn't stop there. That's just an instance of what kind of attention one pays. One notices the simple, banal facts of one's sensory experience. And one notices that they're continually changing, shifting, becoming something else. The iddhapachayata, that this conditions that. This breath, this out-breath, is the condition for the next in-breath. That every event that we attend to, as soon as we notice it, it's gone. It's shifted, it's modulated, it's becoming something else, it's allowing other events to take place, which in turn become the condition for what follows them. He describes this experience as entering a stream, that rather than clutch onto the apparent fixed security of a place, he encourages us to, as it were, dive into this stream of events, to celebrate their transiency, to be open to their tragedy. And likewise, as we look with more stillness and sharpness into these things, to be open to the sheer mystery that they are there at all, rather than not there at all. Now, this ground he speaks of, therefore, is not a ground in the conventional sense of something solid on which you can stand, but it's rather a groundless ground. There's nothing there you can grasp. It's like the river of Heraclitus, in which you cannot step into twice. And that, for the Buddha, is the foundation, and learning to live in that fluid, contingent, unpredictable, and endlessly shifting world is where we can find the possibility of another way of being in this world, one that is not primarily focused on our securing our place, but is one that speaks and comes from, originates in this endlessly unfolding flux of events. So the practice of mindfulness, when we locate it within its earliest traditional source, comes down very much to a kind of profound reorientation. A reorientation, however, that does not seek some higher ground or truth or reality that is outside the phenomenal world, but a total presence and openness to the shifting world itself. So as we continue with this practice today, we might find this idea of place and ground as a kind of template within which to notice what we ourselves do. Of course, the instruction is to pay attention to the breath, pay attention to the sensations in the body, to notice how they're constantly shifting and changing and so on, to somehow become more intimate with this ground, to sustain our attention to this ground, to open ourselves quite radically to this ground. And yet I think we can also learn a great deal from observing how we flee from it, we resist it, we back away from it. We're sitting here happily for a number of moments or minutes in our breath, open to the songs of the birds, planes flying overhead. We feel kind of at ease, perhaps, open. And then suddenly, the next thing you know is the bell rings. And an interval of, say, 5-10 minutes or more has elapsed, in which you've simply not been here. You've been off somewhere. And sometimes you can't even remember what it was that was so seductive that distracted you. It's like you wake up in the morning sometimes and you can't quite recall the dream that you had. Now this can be quite unsettling because it ruptures the illusion that our lives as conscious persons is some kind of unbroken continuum. It's not. What we recollect are often just a series of little islands of consciousness in a sea of forgetting. And what the meditation of mindfulness allows us to become more aware of is how readily we slip into the sea of forgetting. If we're a little bit more conscious of what it is that we fantasize about, I would suggest that much of it has to do with a return to the consolation of some sort of secure place, real or imagined. Our story, the endless reiteration and repetition of our own monologue, which is really just a kind of affirmation of me as something separate, something apart, something in a way monad and isolate. And so when we notice that, we come back to the breath, we come back to the body, we come back to the tread of our feet, to the sound of the plane. And we consciously affirm and recognize and open to that groundless, endlessly slipping away ground. Let's now just stand up for a couple of minutes to stretch our legs and then we'll sit.